When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's time to Let It Roll, the podcast about how and why popular music happens with host Nate Wilcox. Be sure and subscribe to the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Podomatic, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. This week, Nate is joined by author Peter Doggett for the second of two episodes discussing his book, Electric Shock, Recorded Music from the Gramophone to the iPhone. In this episode, Peter continues the tale of the first format wars with radio's sudden mass market emergence in the 1920s and discusses three of the early superstars of recorded music, Enrico Caruso, Burt Williams, and Al Jolson. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and we're surveying musical history. Our guest, Peter Doggett, has returned generously to once again to continue the discussion of his book, Electric Shock. We barely got through the introduction in the first chapter in the first time, so I'm hoping that this episode won't be the last time we get Peter, but he hasn't committed yet. So, Peter, welcome back to the show, and I hope I can count on you for many more episodes.
I'm sure we can do another 10, 12, maybe, something like that.
Awesome, awesome. Glad. Not putting you on the spot at all, but happy to have done it. So we've been talking about your book, which is a history. This is a very ambitious undertaking. Electric Shock, from the Gramophone to the iPhone, 125 years of pop music. It came out a few years ago, and I'd argue that it's already a little bit out of date, but because by ending with the iPhone, you're ending with the MP3 era, and we're already into a new era of streaming. What would you have changed if you had written the book just a couple, like this year, instead of 3 or 4 years ago?
Oh, goodness me. Well, I did incorporate streaming. I'm not sure, certainly in musical terms, I'm not sure how much has changed. And I have to confess that I have pretty much switched my attention off since I finished writing the book. Because the book took me 4 years of research when I was gathering everything from everywhere. And suddenly I didn't have to do that anymore. So I'm just an ordinary person wandering through the world. So I haven't applied quite the same focus to it since cool. I finished writing it.
Well, you'll have to become a subscriber to the Let It Roll podcast and listen to me when I find the guests who have, because I really don't feel like there's been a great history of 21st century or even a good history of 21st century music written yet. And so if we find that person, I'll insist on personally sending you the episode so that you can learn along with us. But I want to start with this. You talk about Claude Debussy, the great French impressionist composer. And he was reflecting on the strangeness of this transformation that occurred after the invention of recorded music. And he said, quote, "In a time like ours, when the genius of engineers has reached such undreamed of proportions, one can hear famous pieces of music as easily as one can buy a glass of beer. It only costs 10 centimes, too, just like the automatic weighing scale. Should we not fear this domestication of sound, this magic preserved in a disc that anyone can awaken at will?" I mean, is he right or is he right?
He's right, and I just for a second while you were reading that, I was trying to imagine living in a world where we didn't have access to recordings, we didn't have access to anything that preserved the past at all. So that let me try and imagine it. Each day's internet dissolved. As soon as you reached midnight, everything had gone and you started afresh the next day. So you lived only in the moment. And what a weird world that would be. But I guess in musical terms, that is the way people lived until music was invented. Now, did that destroy the magic of music? No, I'd argue that it just preserved it and enabled more people to experience it.
But wouldn't you argue that it cost a lot of musicians their jobs? Like, I've had this argument with many critics, and you know, we saw at the end of the CD era and the beginning of the MP3 era a big loss in revenue to the music industry. And a lot of musicians were saying, oh my God, this is the end of an era. You know, people won't be able to afford to make music as a living again. This is the end of the world. But you look back and you read accounts of histories of music before recorded music, and there would literally be a second rush hour in some big cities at the end of the day when the musicians went out to go to work, so that people would come home on the electric trolleys at 5 p.m. and 6 or 6:30, another wave of workers is headed out with their cello cases and their banjos and guitars. I mean, wouldn't you argue that that was sort of an apocalypse to the music industry of its time?
It was, but in lots of ways, history changes in technology. Life is an eternal apocalypse. I mean, and the apocalypses are coming faster and faster the older we all get now, because of the way in which technology has speeded everything up, speeded our lives up, speeded change up. So I understand the point you're making. What was it Neil Young sang about on one of his songs about 1980? Live music is better. Bumper stickers will be issued. And I take Neil Young's point, but Neil Young did very nicely out of royalties for records and songs along the way, of course. I've already mentioned Neil Young. One of the people whose tweets I look at regularly is Neil Young's ex-comrade, Mr. David Crosby. And he is perpetually, first of all, he's perpetually on the road. He's 77 years old. And he's got many illnesses, and he'd much rather be at home with his family. But he says he used to have an income from selling records that's gone. So the only way he can make music now is almost back to the 19th century, is to go back on the road and charge people to come and see him perform in the moment. In a weird way, we've almost gone full circle there.
Absolutely. And another thing where reading your book brings back current memories today is you talk about format wars that literally go back to the very beginning of recorded sound, where Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell and others are competing to create the perfect musical format. I believe it was Emil Berliner's gramophone that competed with Thomas Edison's phonograph. This is like the first version of Betamax versus VHS, or for contemporary users, you know, Spotify versus SoundCloud. Can you give us some of the handicap of the battle between Edison's phonograph and Berliner's gramophone?
Goodness me, that's a big technical subject. Without getting too technical, well, one of the major problems with the cylinder recording was that at the time that technology was invented, there was no way of reproducing it, so that if a performer wanted to sell 5,000 cylinders of a particular performance, they had to make 5,000 individual recordings so that everybody had a slightly different recording. Whereas with Emil Berliner's record, what becomes gramophone. You know, the gramophone record, very early on they discovered ways in which they could be reproduced, they could be copied. So immediately that technology had a huge commercial advantage over the cylinder, even though the cylinder arguably gave much better sound quality. And also, if you had a cylinder recording machine in your home, you could make your own recordings, which obviously you couldn't if you owned the gramophone.
And there's two artists that sort of, to me, epitomize that difference. One is Enrico Caruso, the great classical or operatic singer. And he, I believe, recorded, he was guaranteed an annual income of $100,000 by his death in 1921. And that was from doing sessions on the gramophone where he sang it once and it's mass produced, correct?
That's right, yeah.
And so Caruso, go ahead and tell us about Enrico Caruso, because this is another area where it's just not something I thought about, but classical music was actually a dominant form of popular music at the beginning of the 20th century.
Exactly, which I have to say was a huge surprise to me. I mean, I knew in theory about the idea that there was this operatic tenor called Enrico Caruso, who was very popular. What I didn't think about was that he was competing for sales in the earliest years of the recorded sound industry with the things we were talking about in the previous episode, coon songs, minstrel songs, novelty tunes, and that there wasn't the same divide, at least as far as his music was concerned, between classical and popular, where very much, really, for the last 60, 70, 80 years, you either loved classical music or you loved popular music. With Caruso, the two became the same thing. And so he sold million upon million of operatic arias, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, at most 4 minutes long, as the most piercing beauty. I mean, his voice still, if you hear those recordings that he made now between, 1904 and 1920, you can, through the appalling sound quality and the crackles and the hiss and whatever, you can still hear what a majestic, emotionally overwhelming voice he had. So it's easy to understand why people would get the same pleasure out of hearing his records that they would, I don't know, 50, 60 years later, in hearing Otis Redding or Aretha Franklin.
Absolutely. And there's 2 points I'd want to add to that. One is that even though what he recorded was operatic arias, and as I've discussed with previous guest author Elijah Wald, performers like Robert Johnson, who are known today as blues performers, were actually more like human jukeboxes, where Robert Johnson would not only play blues songs, but he or his contemporary Muddy Waters had a whole set of Gene Autry songs and cowboy songs that he sang in a set. So somebody like Caruso would not only be singing, if you saw him live in 1904, not only be singing operatic arias, but he might be singing the latest pop songs by Irving Berlin, patriotic standards, the Star Spangled Banner, et cetera, et cetera.
And then, that's true. Although in Caruso's case, he almost entirely recorded operatic material. There were a few sort of almost classical songs, like I mentioned in the book, The Lost Chord by Arthur Sullivan. Which, I mean, if you're ever going to play one record by Caruso, The Lost Chord is just the most mind-blowing thing to hear.
And we're going to pause here, and I'm going to try to challenge Steph to track that song down and play it right here.
And my fingers wander wildly over the noisy keys. I don't know what I was playing or what I was dreaming.
And now that we've heard that and given people a taste of Enrico Caruso, and you can't say that the Let It Roll podcast doesn't elevate your culture. So thanks for helping us with that, Peter. But I want to go over something we mentioned briefly in the first episode that you did with us. This was this Charles K. Harris's book, How to Write a Popular Song, from 1906, where he ran through about 12 or 13 categories. And we talked about four of them in the last episode, but I want to run through all of them to give people an idea of what were considered musical genres at the turn of the 20th century. So he had A, the home or mother song, B, the descriptive or sensational story ballad, C, the popular waltz song, which could be on 1,001 subjects, D, the racist coon song, which we discussed at length, and if you're concerned about the racism of that, see the previous episode. E, the march song, so patriotic war song. This is where John Philip Sousa and Stars and Stripes Forever would come in. Then you had the comic song, so somebody like Eddie Cantor or something like that. The production song, which would be coming out of a Broadway play or something like that. The popular love ballad, high class ballad, and sacred songs. So looking at that sort of catalog of genres in 1906, and knowing what you know, Peter, about the history of 20th century music. I mean, compare and contrast that with the genres we had, say, towards the end of the 20th centuries, where you had rock, you had hip hop, you had jazz, soul, et cetera. How many of these sort of niches are eternal, and how many of them were sort of unique to their period and time?
Well, if you pick the very first one you mentioned, which was the home or mother song, now there's a whole tradition of people writing the most mawkishly sentimental songs about their mothers. I mean, Al Jolson recorded several of them. And but there's an element of that which carried right on through country music. I mean, if you think of something like Old Shep that Elvis Presley did, for example, in 1956, it's not about his mom, it's about his dog, isn't it? But but it comes from that same tradition.
He also shoots Old Shep at the end of the song, so hopefully not one that people do with their mother. But yeah, no, I get that. The sentimental ballad has remained. So go on.
Yeah. The sensational story ballad. Well, that might in 1890 have been an account of the Napoleonic Wars or a particularly famous battle in the Civil War or the War of Independence. But I guess if you look at something like Bob Dylan's Hurricane or I don't know, something like that, that would tell a real life story.
I would think of NWA's Straight Outta Compton as a Gen X contemporary example, where they're sort of pre-telling the story of the LA riots.
Yeah, and it's certainly qualifies as descriptive, and it was sure as hell sensational as well, yeah.
Yeah, and definitely the waltz song, I mean, that's just EDM, that's electronic dance music, that's just the dance song. What's the beat?
Might not have the same rhythm as the popular waltz song, but yes. I mean, it seems to me almost every record is a dance record these days, whether that's how it's classified or not, which I have to say is one of the themes of the whole of Electric Shock, was that ultimately when it came down to it, almost every new development in popular music, and I say almost, was triggered by the joy of dancing, the freedom of movement, and the sort of feeling of liberation that music can give you.
And we'll get to ragtime in a minute, which is like the first example you bring up, where African American music brings a new syncopated beat into the world of popular music. But I want to touch on just a couple of these, because obviously the popular love ballad is still very much with us, and we can't escape it from these shows, the Simon Cowell type shows. And then sacred songs still with us, although not a, well, actually with Christian rock and others becoming this really viable music genre, we still have that. And then something like high class ballads, I might blame that category on something like Coldplay, which perhaps snobs like ourselves don't necessarily think of as high class, but they're fulfilling a certain niche for people who like to hear music and think and take themselves somewhat seriously while they listen to it.
Yeah, and in the 1970s, the equivalent of that would have been progressive rock, because I mean, I remember myself being a schoolboy at the time, that if you listened to, I don't know, Genesis or whatever, you felt you were a cut above and you're therefore more intelligent than people who were listening to Deep Purple. Now, from this distance, what a stupid idea. But at the time, that distinction was very important. It was part of one's identity.
Yeah, very much so. And we still obviously have comic songs. One category that we haven't seen recently, and I hope we don't see a great deal of again, is the march song, which I think has an ominous character. I mean, it's one thing to hear Stars and Stripes Forever, the great John Philip Sousa march. It's another thing to hear, you know, Over There, written by Yankee Doodle Dandy. I can't remember the guy's name, but, you know, a World War One ballad. It's another thing entirely to hear one of the Nazi battle songs, the Horst Foscher song or something like that. And so I get sort of the chills when I think of what might be being sung in the border of Russia and Ukraine right now, or somewhere in Syria amongst, you know, like in Nigeria, where Islamic jihadis are fighting with local tribal groups. And so that is a category I at least am not currently aware of being popular, but does put a chill down my spine. But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to upset some people by saying this, and I can't remember the song titles, but I was going to say Toby Keith. And
absolutely.
Actually, one of my
perfect example.
Yep. And also one of my favorite singers, although I don't think he and I would survive a discussion about politics, which is Hank Williams Jr. I mean, what a fantastic voice. What a great singer. What an amazing musician. And an awful lot of his music is basically, from my perspective, spewing
egoistic
out ultra conservative, agenda, which I find distasteful politically, but musically I can listen to. But he wants to arouse people in the same way that your current president does. He wants to get people up on their feet and shouting and
maybe shooting. I mean, somebody like Ted Nugent is somebody who's made this transformation from being seen on the, at least being perceived on the cultural avant-garde at the time when he was playing on the same stages with MC5 and Iggy and the Stooges, to now being on the same stages with Sarah Palin and Donald Trump, and saying things that many scholars identify as hate speech or eliminationist rhetoric, like literally the sort of shit you heard coming out of Serbia in the late 1980s or coming out of Rwanda before the genocide there. And hopefully, obviously, we all hope America isn't reaching that point, but it's very disturbing to hear that kind of shit being spewed all over the media.
And it also brings up the absolutely classic dilemma, which people always talk about in terms of writers like T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, whose work was openly anti-Semitic. It had very harsh caricatures of Jews, or indeed, in Pound's case, outright hatred of Jewish people. Is it therefore okay to enjoy Pound's poetry? Is it okay to still read The Wasteland? And this is something that, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Jerry Lee Lewis, for example. But if you catch some of his asides when you see him perform, or indeed on some of his records, he goes against everything politically that, and culturally that I believe in. I've mentioned Hank Jr. exactly the same. I love the music. Is it okay to love that music when it expresses things that I find absolutely abhorrent? I don't know.
And then if you get into Jerry Lee's case, you know, as a Gen Xer, one of my first exposures to Jerry Lee was reading a Rolling Stone magazine expose that, at least to my 14-year-old mind at the time, I'd have to revisit it before I put myself in a position of being legally challenged by Jerry Lee or his estate. But at the time, it made a credible case that perhaps Jerry Lee, the death of one of Jerry Lee's wives under very suspicious circumstances, might have involved spousal abuse and domestic violence to the point of death. And so when you're talking about somebody like Jerry Lee, who not only did that, but verifiably, bigamously married his underage cousin, you know, or you get into somebody like Ike Turner, who for all he contributed as a musician, I mean, arguably Ike Turner with Rocket 88 is one of the inventors of rock and roll, and his accomplishment in training and cultivating and developing the talent of Tina Turner, I think, is unquestionably one of the great gifts anybody made to 20th century music. And yet, do you want to support this artist?
Yeah, and this is something that we each individually have to face. Particularly, I mean, I think it's happened much less in the States than it has in England, but there have been a whole raft of cases in the last 10, 15 years in England where much loved entertainers, celebrities, disc jockeys have been exposed as child abusers, and in many cases convicted and sent to prison.
You're referring to Gary Glitter, and the late Jimmy Savile. Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Jimmy Savile.
Savile,
and also the children's entertainer, Rolf Harris, who you may not know.
I've heard of him, but not familiar.
Yeah, I think he had one hit single in America. But everybody loved Rolf Harris. He was just part of one's childhood. I saw him performing at a folk festival 3 or 4 years ago. And then you discover all these tales about what he was doing when he had the opportunity in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And incidents of assault, or, you know, indecent assault or whatever, for which he has gone to prison. And suddenly a whole part of your childhood is wiped out. So is it still okay to have fond memories of seeing him on television when you were six, knowing what he's, you know, what he was actually up to at the time? It's an endless dilemma for people these days, I think.
Yeah, and to bring it home to Americans of my generation, he's not a musician, but he was certainly a recording artist. Bill Cosby, who just a few years ago I would have introduced as the great Bill Cosby without even thinking about it because of his contributions to stand-up comedy. I mean, here's a man that everyone from Richard Pryor to Johnny Carson to George Carlin to Chris Rock, I mean, anybody in comedy acknowledges what this man brought to the craft. And for me as a child growing up on his storytelling records about childhood, you know, I'm at a point in my life where I had kids kind of late, and one of the joys of having children is sharing things like the Beatles or movies that you love. I just had the pleasure this weekend, holiday weekend, of sharing The Sound of Music with my son and daughter and the Western movie Shane with my son and daughter. And they both were able to appreciate it. You know, they're 10 and 5, so they're appreciating different things about these movies. But that's one of the great joys of parenthood and cultural cultivation in a small scale. And here we have artists like Bill Cosby or Jerry Lee. Would I want to play my favorite Bill Cosby records for my kids? Part of me is like, of course I would. And part of me is like, I do not want to open this can of worms anywhere near my children.
Exactly. And I guess in a way with someone like Cosby or with Ike Turner, it's easier because they're one individual. But I mean, you mentioned The Sound of Music. I have no idea, but it's quite possible that there is somebody who contributes to The Sound of Music. You know, a producer or a writer or an actor or any of these films.
Or it's possible. All the nuns that were involved, you know, at least, you know, if there were any priests advising, just knowing what we know now about the Catholic Church, of course there would have been a child molester somewhere in the picture.
Yeah.
You know? And I've got one last one I want to bring up. This is well off topic, but while I've got you. When Seville was exposed, and am I still pronouncing that wrong? Is that
you're still pronouncing it wrong? Savile.
Forgive my Americanism and Texasism. But when Savile was a beloved, popular figure, I believe he was knighted and was a huge charity giver. He was not exposed until after his death. Like the media was, he had so much power, people couldn't even go after him until after he was dead. Sort of like I imagine what may or may not happen to R. Kelly someday. But I have hope that R. Kelly will face justice sooner than that. But then you've got somebody like Gary Glitter, who had already been caught first on the internet and then traveling to Vietnam. I mean, obviously, this man has a deep sickness of pedophilia. But after Seville was exposed, there was a series of news articles about how other celebrities from his era might be prosecuted. And at first I'm thinking, wow, is Jimmy Page and Mick Jagger, are they having sleepless nights right now? What's Sir Elton John thinking about right now? Because certainly the moray in the early 70s, age of consent was not a factor. You know, I mean, that was just from my, at least, readings of the period, sleeping with, for a 20-year-old or 18-year-old male performer to have sex with a 12 or 13-year-old female fan was thought of as nothing, you know, whereas currently we've got, I can't pronounce the kid's name, but 69 or something that is currently under prosecution for being videotaped having sex as an 18-year-old with a 13-year-old girl. So the standards have changed completely. But I thought, oh, wow, are we going to see somebody big go down? You know, maybe like remember when Pete Townsend had his brief period where he's accused of looking at pedophilia on the internet. And instead, they just charged Gary Glitter with yet another case of child rape. I mean, did you feel like that the big stars with big money were getting off the hook in that episode?
Not mentioning any names. Yes, I did.
Wiser than me. Obviously, all these things are just alleged, but they're very well documented.
Well, yes, but you also make the very good point that we won't put any names up, but let's suppose there's a world-beating 1960s band who toured the world in the 60s, and they have got girls queuing up outside their dressing rooms, hotel rooms, backstage at cinemas or whatever, stadia, you know, anywhere they're playing. And basically these girls want to get close to the group. That's all they're interested in doing. Now, whether the girls actually realize what that might entail, one doesn't know. But an awful lot of them basically want to get naked with the group. Now, the group are on tour. They're not thinking about, okay, we better make sure, have they got passports? Have they got birth certificates? You know, they're just going, she's cute. Okay, I'll have her and I'll have her. They can't remember, no doubt, the next day who they had sex with and who they didn't. Lots of these kids must have had babies. I mean, you know, in the 1960s, 50s, lots of the young girls must have had babies.
And to name somebody we can name since he's dead, we know from the biography of Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones alone that here's a guy by the time he was 23 had, what, 6, 7 illegitimate children? And that was before he was even a rock star.
Exactly, yeah. So you think how many other children there must be. And so looking at it from our perspective today, you can say, well, it was immoral of those pop stars to take advantage of their fame like that. But against that, they have been catapulted from meaning nothing in the world to being the most famous people in the world overnight. And that screws with your head. And so you do stuff which morally, looking back 50 years later, you go, oh, actually, I wish I hadn't done that. But at the time, it's like, pleasure, great, go for it. You know, these are young guys, they're just going to go for whatever they want. So I'm not excusing them, but I'm just saying that it was so much part of the culture. There was nobody supervising the kids. There was nobody supervising the musicians, the entertainers. It was going to happen. But yes, my gut feeling is that if they started at A in the alphabet of popular entertainers from the 60s and 70s and said, okay, John Aardvark, the famous rock and roll star, is going to be arrested because he had sex with a 14-year-old groupie, well, they're going to have to work their way all the way through to Z and, you know, Frank Zappa and beyond, and basically prosecute every musician who's ever gone on tour, because I apologize to any musicians out there who've never done that kind of thing, but an awful lot did.
Yeah, and it brings to mind the old saying, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so somebody who had the kind of fame and power like somebody like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones had in the 60s, which was thrust upon them with no preparation. These were not like nobles who were raised with a sense of noblesse oblige and social responsibility. These were just kids who stumbled into this wealth and fame and musical power. But we've wandered way far from the topic I wanted, but it's been fascinating. But I wanted to compare another performer with Enrico Caruso that we talked about. Caruso, obviously the great operatic singer who was on one side of the format wars. He was using a gramophone, so he could record a performance once and they could duplicate it. Now, a different performer who was almost as popular but is completely forgotten now. I certainly had never heard of him, although now you can look him up on YouTube. You describe him as a former slave, George Washington Johnson, billed himself, this is what he billed himself as, the original whistling coon and laughing darkie. And this guy inaugurated a long tradition of what you call laughing records with his 1891 recording of the Laughing Song. And basically, this is a sound of this man laughing in a very entertaining way. I mean, it's still a record that I played for my child and delighted her. You know, she knew nothing of the context, but something in George Washington Johnson's performance communicated across the centuries. But this guy, because he was recording for the Edison phonograph on a cylinder, he had to repeat that performance an estimated 40,000 times so that a fresh cylinder could be made from each rendition. And each one of these is viciously self-mocking with its casual references to a, quote, huckleberry N-word and, quote, a big baboon. Now, the contrast between the way Enrico Caruso is treated and the way that George Washington Johnson is treated, you could not get a better capsule description of the racial inequality of the early part of the 20th century. And I want to thank you for sharing that.
Okay, well, yes, it's true and it's very sad.
And yeah, would you agree with me that if you hear George Washington Johnson's work, something valuable comes through?
Sure, definitely, yes. Well, that's all. We're almost back to where we were 5, 10, 15 minutes ago talking about Jerry Lee Lewis or whatever, because is it okay to take pleasure from that at this point? I mean, this was a guy who was making a living the best way he knew how. And if the only way he could make a living was to make fun of his own race, then at least he could eat. And who are we now to say, well, he shouldn't have done it?
Absolutely. And to me, there's a big difference. You have to take in intent and what was the artist's goal here. And I believe that George Washington Johnson, I have to assume, was just as human as you or I and had the same sort of blind drive that a salmon has swimming upstream trying to reproduce itself. He knew he had a musical gift and he was seeking immortality.
Exactly, yes. And he wasn't setting out with the political purpose of doing down his own race. He was merely trying to survive. And as a polar opposite of that, I remember being amazed when I wrote a book about the history of the interaction between country music and rock music, which was called Are You Ready for the Country?
A great book, by the way. I'm hoping to get back on to talk about that sometime too.
Well, I came across a whole strand of music that I'm sad to say came from the southern United States of rockabilly singles that were outwardly racist, that were intended for dissemination amongst the KKK or whatever. And they included things like N-word hating me. And the awful thing is it's a great record to hear it. It's a really catchy country rock record.
Yeah, and I'm not even, and I'm having mixed emotions about, part of me wants to be the 10-year-old Nathan and say, oh, I know the answer. And part of me doesn't really want to tell people where to find that song. Because like you say, it is a very powerful song. And unfortunately, we're in an era where once again, Nazis are on the march, both in the U.S., across Europe, through Brazil, all the way, into Russia, all the way east into China, we're having these racial spats. So I'm not going to name check it, nor am I going to name check, say, a particular 80s hardcore band that became the flagship of the Nazi skinhead movement in the 80s. And yet, at least their first album is really powerful music. So yeah, it's this continual thing. And that's one of the great things about Electroshock is it really reminds one that nothing new is under the sun, that we're seeing these same stories, these same fights. And it's sort of like a matter to me of pick your role models and who are you going to try to emulate, keeping in mind that the situations have changed and you could end up making the Christopher Hitchens mistake to get well out of field, where Hitchens admired George Orwell and used that as a moral compass and then finds himself at the end of his life supporting G.W. Bush and Tony Blair's illegal invasion of Iraq. So again, forgive the aside, but I want to talk about another figure that from the perspective of 2018 is going to seem controversial. I mean, I can imagine some of my, especially younger African-American friends, they hear about Burt Williams, who billed himself as the famous chocolate-covered coon. That was a white man who Burt Williams objected to a white man, G.H. Eliot, billing himself as the famous chocolate-covered coon. And Burt Williams' counter was that he was the real black artist. And, how do you view somebody like Burt Williams, who was the first African-American superstar, who did legitimize African-Americans on Broadway, who opened the doors for generations of African-American musicians? I mean, I think you could argue without Burt Williams, you have no Louis Armstrong as a pop figure. You have no Duke Ellington as an elder, maybe Ellington because of the Scott Joplin thing, but you definitely don't have, Armstrong. You don't have the Ink Spots. You don't have Nat King Cole. You don't have Ray Charles, et cetera, et cetera. Where do you put Burt Williams in your line of is this something to be celebrated with a caveat, or is this something to be studied but not really listened to? How do you categorize Burt Williams in this?
I think if you hear him, you celebrate him. And then the examples I picked out in the book were I'd never come across him. I'd never heard of him even before I started doing the research for this book. And I couldn't believe that there was this compelling, charismatic figure who was making all these records before the First World War, many of them. But he sounded as alive to me as the 50s rock and rollers did when I first heard those guys around 1970. Not only that, but you could clearly hear, as you say, his influence on later people. You can hear Chuck Berry in Burt Williams. You can hear the Coasters, all those great Leaver Stoller records that were made in the 50s. It's in his phrasing. It's just the air of relaxation and humor. And he's somebody who inhabits his own skin with confidence and with charisma and
dignity.
Yeah, exactly. Which completely dispels all those awful cultural things that we've been talking about earlier, which was what he came out of.
And I'm going to take the opportunity again to play a song here. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm going to assume that your pick from a Burt Williams recording to listen to would be Nobody.
Well, yes. Although having mentioned the Coasters.
I have not mentioned them. I mean, we've obviously talked about them on the shows with Ed Ward and others, yeah. But you do mention the clear line of descent from Burt Williams' sly drawl on "He's a Cousin of Mine" knowing narratives of the Coasters vignette. So yeah. Would you go with, we could play both. You want to do Nobody and a taste of "He's a Cousin of Mine" as well?
Sure, yeah.
All right, stuff. So cue those up for us.
I never done nothing to nobody. I never got nothing from nobody, no time. Oh, until I get something from somebody, sometime.
Don't you go acting here like a dun. He's a cousin of mine, tough cousin of mine. You're liable to see me at most any old time. You're just like a bee, you're all time buzzing. Ain't no harm, just a hug and kiss your cousin. I haven't seen Jerry in the last 10 years, and you know that's a mighty long time. He's my mother's sister's angel child. Gone man, that's a cousin of mine. Ha ha!
And so that was the great Burt Williams. And Peter, I have to agree with you. I think anybody who hears Burt Williams, sees photographs of Burt Williams, reads about Burt Williams, if you can't hear the dignity and power and beauty of that music, I think you might be deaf. So thanks very much for sharing that. And again, I had never I had heard of Burt Williams, but never paid any attention to him before this book. So that's one of many gifts. And I think anybody who reads Electric Shock is going to find just a wealth of new music, new old music to hear about. But let's get back to sort of the cultural changes that are going on at the same time. Because like you and Ed Ward and others have pointed out, the music doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's a mix of technology and cultural shifts. And there's this panic when ragtime first becomes popular. And to our perspective, I mean, to me as a Gen Xer, I associate ragtime with a beloved old Robert Redford, Paul Newman movie, The Sting, like you mentioned on the previous episode. And yet, social critics at the time were literally panicking about ragtime as if it was something truly dangerous, like Elvis Presley or N.W.A.
Exactly, and it's because, as much as anything, of syncopation, it throws young people's bodies into unusual rhythms. As far as people who are raised on, I don't know, light opera and vaudeville were concerned. It encourages them to fling themselves around, maybe to indulge in close bodily contact with people of the opposite sex. And this sort of moral panic, which partly comes out of race, but more than anything comes out of the fear of sexualizing young people, is something that is repeated all the way through at least the next 50 years of popular music, right the way through to rock and roll. And it was something I was really struck by when I was doing the research, was that almost every new musical form, particularly if they came out of black music, as they arrived, you would get the people in the same positions. You would get church leaders, you'd get politicians, you'd get top educators, school teachers or whatever, and of course one's own parents saying, this is the most immoral thing I have ever seen or heard. And then within 5 or 10 years, it would be just sort of sucked up into the culture and would lose all that power. And okay, society's then ready for the next outrage.
Yeah, and literally the next generation will be saying, back in my day, we had wonderful music like ragtime, but this swing stuff is just over the line. And it's fascinating to see this repeated. But I do want to read this quote you've got about ragtime from an 1898 American magazine called The Etude. It determined that ragtime is a, quote, term applied to the peculiar, broken, rhythmic features of the popular coon song. It has a powerfully stimulating effect, setting the nerves and muscles tingling with excitement. Its aesthetic effect is the same as that in the monotonous, recurring, rhythmic chant of barbarous races. I mean, and then it says, wraps up with, unfortunately, the words to which it is allied are usually decidedly vulgar, so its present great favor is somewhat to be deplored. So this music magazine, like, it hits all the buttons: the sex, the fear of alien, what they call barbarous cultures, but they can't even bring themselves to fully deplore the music. Like, it had some kind of power that even the music snobs had to recognize.
Exactly, because before you got to the line about the barbarous races from the jungle or whatever it was, it actually sounded like a public relations puff piece on behalf of, you know, how exciting this ragtime music is. So it was actually a lot more open-minded, broad-minded as a response to ragtime than most critics of the time would have been.
And another change that was going on at the same time was the explosion of what we called dance halls. And this again is something I hadn't thought about, but before World War I, and I think this was, you know, as a Brit, you're more focused on England than most American historians, who tend to ignore our cousins on the other side of the Atlantic. But suddenly, you know, dancing before World War I was something that happened very much in a controlled context. I mean, you imagine something like a dance scene out of a Jane Austen movie, you know, where a few families get together, they invite their young people as a way of pairing off in a very controlled circumstance. They're dancing to very regular rhythms. You know, they're encouraged to dance with a variety of partners so that no particular physical chemistry heats up. And suddenly, after World War I, for one thing, there is a massive shortage of young men in England. And you have all these women that are flocking to cities to work for the war effort. And now they have to create a social milieu on the. And suddenly the mores change completely, and people are literally going out and dancing with strangers, not just people, but quote-unquote respectable young women. I mean, talk about that change and how big a deal it was at the time.
Well, it was exemplified by the plight of the people who came home from the trenches in World War I, who had left their wives and sweethearts as these very, very sweet, innocent, as far as they were concerned, refined young women, and came back to find them throwing gay abandon, you know, gyrating on dance floors to steps that the soldiers had never heard before. They didn't understand this music, because what had happened during the First World War was that ragtime had changed into jazz, or jazz had emerged out of ragtime, whilst the First World War was going on. So as a social change, that was incredible. But I mean, you mentioned dance halls. I mean, all the way through, certainly I can only really talk from experience about England, but right the way up until the mid 60s, young couples automatically went out to dance halls didn't matter what class they came from, whether they were very rich or very poor, but they went out as couples usually, or hoping to be in a couple, to dances. So that, for example, is how my parents met in the 1950s. That would be the early 1950s. It was the main focus, that and the cinema, for young people's lives. And so that changes to an extent in the 60s. I mean, we're getting way ahead of ourselves here. But I would say once again these days, an awful lot of young people's social lives appears to me to involve going to clubs and so on, where, okay, all sorts of things are imbibed and taken in other ways, but fundamentally it comes down to dancing again. So that's been a sort of continuum through the history, really.
And here's one where, again, I want to sort of pull a Gen X rank on you. I'm slightly, just barely younger than you. But like in my good old days, we had things called raves where you took harmless drugs like MDMA and you listened to things like the Happy Mondays, and maybe you met somebody and maybe you didn't and had a wonderful time. And today it seems like, from what I'm reading about on the internet as an old man who's not participating, that the kids today are swiping right on Tinder or Grindr or whatever the app of their choice is, and that I wonder if the music is bringing kids together sexually the way it used to.
I'm not sure, but I am sure about one thing, which is kids will find a way to get together sexually one way or another.
It's true, although if you read some of the data, it seems that they're not doing as much as they used to. But before, I only have a very short time left with you, and I want to talk about two artists that I think are critical. We already talked about Burt Williams and George Washington Johnson and Enrico Caruso, which I wanted to cover. But there's one songwriter and one performer from this era of the teens that I want to cover, which is Irving Berlin, the author of everything from Alexander's Ragtime Band through White Christmas, God Bless America, Let's Face the Music and Dance, Putting on the Ritz, Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better, et cetera, et cetera. And I already tried in the previous episode to make my argument that he was merely the Paul McCartney of his day, or rather that Paul McCartney is merely the Irving Berlin of his day, and that he too may fade the way Irving Berlin did. But the second one is Al Jolson, who has fascinated me since I became aware of him, because he's somebody who from 1910 to 1950 was universally acknowledged as the king of entertainment in America and the UK. I mean, if you read an account of the Marx Brothers or Jack Benny or George Burns or any contemporary of his, they all put Jolson on this untouchable pedestal. And yet, when we hear Jolson, or first off, when we see Jolson, we see blackface and assume that he's some sort of racist. And when we hear him, he's clearly coming from he did not learn how to sing to the microphone the way Bing Crosby or Louis Armstrong would just a generation later. He's singing to the back of the hall in a Broadway review. So I realize I'm putting you on the spot with like 2 seconds to tell me about Irving Berlin and Al Jolson, but I just got to hear what you think about those two guys.
Well, with Al Jolson first, yes, exactly. I, as somebody who got into music at the end of the 60s, Al Jolson, if I knew him at all, was just a guy in blackface who was therefore very embarrassing. And it's only when you see film of him, and how I wish there was film of him back from his heyday, from 1915 or 1920 or something, because I think to actually see him performing to a real audience then, rather than a film camera, would have been incredible. But we've already mentioned charisma with Burt Williams. Yes, Al Jolson is trying to sell himself to the back row of every, the biggest hall in the world. But he exudes passion. He exudes the joy of singing and the wholehearted, giving every ounce of himself to every performance. And I explain in the book how he was famous for singing the same songs in a different way every night, in the same way that in more recent years Bob Dylan would do or Van Morrison would do. And so his aficionados would go along and go, oh, did you hear the way he sang Mammy tonight? What about that second verse,
So well, Grateful Dead would be the definitive, yeah, I think, example.
Exactly, yeah. So he was a natural-born entertainer and a natural-born improviser. And in terms of his historical status, it's a tragedy for him that the tradition he chose to plant himself in was the the tradition of the blacked-up minstrel singer, because I think if he hadn't done that, which at the time wasn't seen in general terms as being insulting, if he hadn't done that, then I think it would be much easier for later generations to appreciate his genius.
And I just want to cut in because I think there's some deep sort of tragic ironies here of the American cultural experience in that Jolson, as a East European immigrant of Jewish faith to America, who grew up in Maryland surrounded by African Americans. And this was part of the Jewish experience in America for a great deal of the early part of the 20th century, was that Jews were not seen as fully quote unquote white and were frequently marginalized in the same neighborhoods as other quote unquote undesirable minorities like the Irish or African Americans. And so Jolson is a very organic American experience where he grew up just like Hank Williams would later, or just like Elvis Presley would later, or Bob Wills, or any of these other figures of, you know, musical synthesis. He grew up amongst the African Americans, learning their music and sharing his music. And so when he took on the minstrel tradition, he's trying to be American. And he's also trying to celebrate African American culture. And I believe you talk about it in the book, that African American musicians at the time appreciated him very much as both a musical advocate and a literal ally, somebody who helped integrate hotels and stages.
Yeah, definitely, very much so. And in so many ways, almost everything you said about Al Jolson applies to Irving Berlin as well, because he was born in Russia, he was a Russian Jew, so he would have suffered exactly the same kind of sort of cultural prejudice in his youth that Al Jolson suffered. And he worked his way up from as a child. He was being hired to sit in the stalls or in the circle of theatres and shout for encores of particular songs. He was being given money by the publishers to try and get people excited, and he would be singing requests as a waiter in restaurants, and then eventually discovered he could write his own songs, only using the black keys of the piano, mind you, because he didn't know how to play properly. And he had an unquenchable supply of amazing melodies, so many of which we have inherited today. And he transcended genre. He almost transcended race, in that his songs could be and were performed by black performers as well as white performers. And his reach, I mean, the fact that he was still writing songs in the 1960s, 1970s, having started before the First World War. I mean, it's just incredible.
And having hits all the way into the 1950s. So, yeah. You know, just an incredible run. And I would argue, you know, if we were having this conversation in 1950, that Jolson and Irving Berlin would have status very much comparable to that of Stevie Wonder or Mick Jagger today, where they're just acknowledged as these cultural titans that everyone grew up with and loves, et cetera, et cetera. So, Peter Doggett, thanks again for doing these two episodes. Hope I can have you back on again, because I swear we could talk about this book for another 15 episodes. It is a great book. It's called Electroshock, From the Gramophone to the iPhone, 125 Years of Pop Music. And thanks, Peter. This has just been a delightful conversation.
Well, it's been great fun, and I have a feeling I'll see you again.
All right. We'll definitely take you up on it. So that's it for this episode of Let It Roll. And Peter, thanks again. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Next week, author David Wondrich is Nate's guest to discuss his overlooked classic, Stomp and Swerve, How American Music Got Hot, 1843 to 1924. Be sure and subscribe to the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Podomatic, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Electric Shock, recorded music from the gramophone to the iPhone, is available from Random House and can be found wherever fine books are sold.